want to say a few words. So welcome to Longmont Shambhala Meditation Group. Roland and I have known each other since, what, New York in the 70s or something?
Something, yeah. New York, early 70s.
Yeah.
That's right.
And he's been teaching for quite a while, and he was in New Zealand for years and actually started a group in Auckland, was it?
Well, the last group was started there. I started in Christchurch.
Christchurch.
But I continued the groups in Auckland and Wellington.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And so now he's back here, and he's teaching both in Boulder and other places. And we're very glad to have him back among our Longmont family and hope to see more of him.
Thank you. It's great to be back. This is a great space. It really is. Great. Well, let's start with a bow. And since this is a Buddhist class, I mean, this is truly a Buddhist course, we'll start with a Buddhist bow. It was always a kind of a funny thing in our community, you know, because when Trigam Trungpa, the founder, was teaching Shambhala, we'd all do Shambhala bows. And when he was teaching Buddhism, we would do Buddhist bows. Mm-hmm. And sometimes there were two things going on at once, and you never knew. You know, you would kind of... Yeah, right, right, right.
Yeah, we'd do the dedication and merit like that, and then... Yeah.
Right, and then a Shambhala bow at the end of the talk. It was like, wow, interesting. Well, I'm very, very delighted to be able to present the first in this course. Is it working?
It's working well.
Okay,
looks like.
Good. On the four immeasurables. Now I'm going to say, I thought it would be an auspicious beginning to say what those are and how we say them. The way we say them, and then I'll tell you what they are. We say, may all sentient beings enjoy happiness and the root of happiness. May they be free from suffering and the root of suffering. May they not be separated from the great happiness devoid of suffering. May they dwell in the great equanimity free from passion, aggression, and prejudice. So those are the four immeasurables. And the first one, may all sentient beings enjoy happiness and the root of happiness, is loving kindness. And I'm not going to get into why, because that's what the course is about. So really, each time one is presented, they're going to go in depth into why it's called that and what it's about. The second one is, may all sentient beings enjoy happiness and the root of happiness. May they be free from suffering and the root of suffering. That's compassion. May they not be separated from the great happiness devoid of suffering is joy. And may they dwell in the great equanimity free from passion, aggression, and prejudice is equanimity. And these are actually... a very well-used practice within the Mahayana. Has everyone here heard the term Mahayana before? Are you familiar with it? Yes, okay, everyone. That's great. Because I was going to really sort of just give a beginning sort of explanation of the three yanas. I may as well say anyway,
just to reiterate,
yeah, just to go over the ground a little bit. Yeah. So this course is material presented by both Sakyong Mipham Rinpoche, Trigam Trungpa Rinpoche, and many other teachers that we've studied with. And it's from the body of teachings called the Mahayana teachings, which means Maha is great, or great, or what's another meaning for that? Maha great, or many? I can't remember. And Yana means vehicle or palanquin, in the Tibetan anyway. So great vehicle. And of course there's three vehicles within Tibetan Buddhism. The first one is called Hinayana or Theravada. The second one is Mahayana. And the third one is Vajrayana. Hinayana means lesser vehicle. Sometimes it's retranslated as meaning foundation vehicle rather than lesser, because actually all of them are pervaded by the others. So Hinayana is the foundation of all the other yanas. You can't have them without the Hinayana. So it's not that it's less profound, but it's just more having to do with where we begin and working with self-liberation, liberating this solid feeling of me and the ego. That's where we have to begin. And then gradually through practice, there's a natural evolution to what's called the Mahayana, the greater vehicle, which is really where you begin to take a much vaster view of sentient beings, of all the different sentient beings, and that your journey no longer is just about liberating yourself, but now it becomes about liberating all sentient beings. And that's the motivation for the journey. As a Mahayana practitioner, that's why it's considered huge, because there's countless sentient beings. So it's a huge vision. And it's huge also in many ways. So one of the ways that we talk about the Mahayana is vast and profound. I'll say, remind me if I forget, but I'll say a little more about that in a minute. And then the third vehicle is called Vajrayana. Vajra means indestructible or adamantine. That's like a diamond, indestructible. And the Vajrayana vehicle is really the pinnacle of the Mahayana. It's the fruition of the Mahayana journey, which is great, complete, unsurpassable, complete, great enlightenment, is the fruition of the Mahayana journey, as the Buddha, same as the Buddha. And from that perspective of complete enlightenment, it's possible to utilize those skillful means and the knowledge of reality that emanates from that perspective of enlightenment, to utilize that within your path. So we say it's taking fruition as path. So therefore you have all kinds of, deities, etc., mantras and mudras and deities and visualizations. And you're basically utilizing the way an enlightened person sees the universe, and you are actually emulating that view, that taking that view yourself as a means of connecting with your Buddha nature directly, and also as a way of very quickly utilizing the awakened energy and blessings of those who have realized enlightenment, utilizing it directly as part of your path. So it becomes a very potent and very potent way of working with waking up, because rather than from the perspective of being asleep, you're taking the perspective of your Buddha nature, which is, I've always been awake. So that's the Vajrayana approach, which is very esoteric in the sense that it's little understood, perhaps, by Hinayanists, and even some Mahayanists kind of say, well, that's not real Buddhism. But of course, from the point of view of the Hinayana, Mahayana, well, that's not real Buddhism either. So, and then it goes on that way, of course, probably the way it does in any tradition, that those who practice one particular sect perhaps thinks that the others don't quite get it. And so you do have that, to some extent, happening. But it's interesting that the Vajrayanas actually, they hopefully don't look down upon the purely Mahayanas, because it is Mahayana Buddhism. Vajrayana is Mahayana, and it is Hinayana. So actually, they respect very much the teachings of the Buddha in all its forms. So it doesn't work that way both ways. It's mostly, people who feel, well, the Buddha didn't say that. So therefore, it couldn't be real. But the logic used by the Vajrayanas is, well, nothing was written down until 500 years after, 50 years or something, 100 years, I can't remember, after the Buddha died. The first, was it 50 years after he died, 100 years?
I don't know.
It was long after he died.
About 90.
There was no written language.
Right.
And I think, was it 100 years later?
About 90.
90 years later.
Was the first.
Right, so that's probably the second generation of Buddhists. Mm-hmm. Not even the first ones who heard the Buddha mm-hmm. weren't even present, maybe. So how can you, be sure? But we can be sure because, we can be sure that these teachings are authentic because they've been practiced, they've been studied, they've been commented upon by countless realized beings. And so we can see that, and we can feel it in our own practice, in our own connection, that it's completely powerful and filled with blessings and very skillfully presented in ways that we can connect with our experience. So one of the things the Buddha, you know, says somewhere, you know, is as Buddhism continues, you know, it's going to have to change. Things are going to have to change. The way things are taught need to be current with how people function. And so it has been. When whatever country it goes to, it takes on some qualities of that culture. And now it's been in this country for, I don't know, 50 years or so. And you know, our teacher certainly started in 68, I think he came to America, somewhere around there. And there were a couple of people here, Zen teachers, before him. And so Buddhism has been in this culture now for, you know, not even 100 years. And yet, I mean, the word Dharma, you know, people no longer look at you weird if you say you meditate, you know. When you use the word mindfulness, virtually every university now teaches something about mindfulness. It's become, it really has seeped into the culture. So the thing about Hinayana, or Theravada teachings, is that the emphasis is really on, as I said, self, what's called self-liberation. And this is no small thing, self-liberation, because basically it's saying to see through the confusion and fixation that creates this sense of a truly existing separate self, solid me, and to whom we reference everything to. This is the feeling we have as an ego, as a person who still has an ego, is that everything is happening from somewhere to me or from me to someone. So there's this always this feeling of dualism taking place. And we also are very invested in feeling good and feeling happy, and we don't want to feel pain or sad. So constantly we are involved in our agendas, mentally and emotionally, which we project onto every single situation, including internal situations. So we're constantly involved in somewhat of a fantasy world, connected with trying to get what we want and avoid what we don't want. And so this is the reason we're suffering, is we're not actually fully in contact with reality. We are actually suffering because we are confused and deluded by this activity that we're always engaged in of trying to tweak our experience into something that will last and make us feel good, and to avoid what doesn't feel good. So we're always involved in some kind of action that has to do with promoting our own, and perhaps even those we love, happiness. But there's a sense that we can't just be with things as they are. We always have to tweak them. And this actually creates a tremendous sense of struggle. We're always struggling because we can't just be simply with what is, even in our own minds. So many of us suffer from our own minds because we don't know how to relate with ourselves simply and directly and with actual friendliness. So this is what develops through meditation practice, is a sense that we begin to get to know ourselves, and we begin to be able to relax with all the different states of mind that arise within us, because we're practicing a practice that emphasizes learning how to be unbiased towards our experience. That's meditation practice. It's really learning to be not for or against anything that arises in our mind. And this is something that's subtle. You know, we need to really work with someone to realize, am I still being biased? We need to have a meditation instructor periodically to know, because it's so subtle that sometimes we use meditation itself to try to get a certain experience. That's a common malady that meditators end up having, is that we're attached to certain feelings about meditation. So that applies to everything in our lives, that very subtle manipulating of our experience based on our beliefs, hopes, and fears, and our agendas, etc. So we're always involved in some kind of ego game. And you could say, right up till complete enlightenment, we are. Mm-hmm. So, you know, even the bodhisattvas subtly have, you know, some vestiges of beliefs and projections taking place until they attain unsurpassable complete great enlightenment, at which point the whole game is different, changes at that point. It's not a game anymore. But I think, you know, the point here is that the view taken in the Hinayana is really that there's this whole problem with confusion and fixation is something that has to be purified, and that essentially, if you've completely purified it, then you become free of suffering, and that then you could help others to become free of suffering. But basically, that's the goal: is to become free of suffering, free of basic confusion around, you know, always having to adjust everything. But the problem there is that it's not, from the point of view of Mahayana, one hasn't relaxed quite enough yet, because still there is the idea that there is my peace, and then there's other people. We could help other people. That's a very big part of Hinayana. You know, loving kindness practices, all kinds of practices. But there's still this notion that we can't fully mix ourselves with their confusion and work with them in a, you know, putting actually the freedom of others as being more primary than our own enlightenment, which is exactly what the Bodhisattva vow is, you know, may I not enter into final peace until all sentient beings have attained enlightenment. So this is quite a difference in the approach from Hinayana, which is really more about cessation of suffering, and therefore, not that that's a small thing, that's not a small thing, but then there's still some sense of not fully being able to mix yourself with others, because you then have resolved everything, and you're kind of different now. You know, you're an arhat. You're not suffering anymore. So therefore, you could help others, but you're not willing to see that it's not over. The path isn't over until actually their suffering is stopped, and that there isn't a difference. Actually, in reality, we're not separate. So it's not full non-duality yet from the Mahayana point of view. So therefore, maybe I'm getting a little bit intellectual, but sometimes that's helpful. So therefore, there's a natural, if you are in the Mahayana lineage, then there's a natural evolution that takes place and is encouraged once you begin to really see that you don't need to struggle so much with yourself, and you can begin to really make friends with yourself. And not only that, but there's a tremendous amount of clarity that's beginning to emerge in your path, because you are no longer projecting so much into the space between you and others. So therefore, you're beginning to see more clearly that others' suffering, others, what others are going through, and it begins to penetrate you, and you feel it, and you actually begin to work with the whole Mahayana vision, which is that their suffering is something that you need to help them to be able to overcome that. But more than that, you can actually not regard it as a problem for you. You work with suffering of the world and others as being part of you. You actually completely take it on. So there's no sense that you're just sort of picking and choosing, well, I can work with this, I can't work. No, you're actually saying, I'm here as a bridge, as a ship, as a, you know, as a means for others to attain liberation and enlightenment until all of them have. So therefore, you're saying, I'm not going to get absorbed into nirvana. I'm not going to leave. I'm going to continue out of compassion as long as it takes until samsara is emptied. And because Mahayana takes that view, therefore you start to connect with that unconditional view, because you can't be conditional about that. It's crazy to think that you're going to, you know, it doesn't work in terms of ordinary logic, because there are limitless beings. Therefore, how is it possible to liberate all of them? So you end up, you know, in a way, the Hinayana is very logical and very precise, amazingly precise, and amazingly skillful, and exquisite, and to the degree to which it dissects and shows how confusion works and how ego works. Everything has been understood to such a minutia that you could spend many lifetimes trying to actually, you know, read everything there is to read about, you know, how the skandhas work and all these things. So entering the Mahayana is really kind of stepping beyond kind of ordinary logic completely. You're stepping beyond that. And you're saying, well, actually, fundamentally, I've discovered that always there has been this enlightened nature that has always been a part of me from the beginning. And the more that I, you know, the more I open up to others and really work with confusion and suffering, the more I begin to see that there's also some kind of innate caring that begins to happen. It's the way the heart really is. So this is what we call bodhicitta. The bodhicitta begins to emerge, which is this feeling of a longing to be able to save others, to help others. You begin to want to figure out, how am I going to be able to do that? And so that's the beginning of what we call, that's at the point at which one enters, really formally enters the Mahayana, is the point at which they take the Bodhisattva vow. And they say somewhat symbolically that you receive the bodhicitta. It's like it's transplanted into you. Of course, it's really showing you, you know, your own Buddha nature. But the bodhicitta, this kind of desire for complete enlightenment for all beings, that vision, that Mahayana vision, is something which gets, you know, you take a vow and you enter formally into that journey, the Bodhisattva path. At that point, you know, you're told, well, you need to actually work at cultivating bodhicitta, which is the desire for enlightenment, the awakened heart. So bodhi is awake, and citta is heart. Bodhicitta. Now, there's a slight distinction between bodhicitta and Buddha nature. Buddha nature is actually, it's really just a point of view. It's not really different, but it's how you look at something. So one way it's described, it's like the, you know, it's like from the point of view of the people on Earth looking at the sun, it seems to be behind the clouds. From the point of view of the sun looking at the Earth appears to be behind the clouds. The sun's always there. But from the point of view of the people on Earth, the sun is coming and going based on the weather, right? So that's like Buddha nature is always there. And maybe the bodhicitta is really the desire to, you know, experience the reality of the sun always being there, because it is always there. So that's the knowledge that you gain when you begin to practice Mahayana. The knowledge is that actually all we're doing is uncovering Buddha nature here. We're not adding anything, nothing whatsoever. Our basic nature right now is no different than the Buddha. So that's a very different perspective from the Hinayana perspective. So bodhicitta is really this necessary kind of discovery of the heart of the matter. It's the heart, how we train to cultivate compassion and how we train to realize Buddha nature fully. So there's two aspects to bodhicitta. The first aspect is called relative bodhicitta, And the second aspect is called ultimate bodhicitta. So I'm going to look at my notes here.
Can I ask a question? Or you?
Of course you can, sure. Please
so
do.
What is the point of view of Hinayana? I never knew that.
Well,
was called
no, well, they have the view that all relative reality is due to causes and conditions. And that's actually the view of, you know, their view of emptiness, of how they view emptiness, or right? It's different than shunyata, but it's sort of beginnings of shunyata. It's the idea of interdependent origination. So it's kind of like, you know, you have the possibility of realizing the cessation of confusion. And at that point, you have attained arhatship. But from their point of view, becoming a Buddha is a very specific thing, and not everyone does that. Not everyone has that path. Only the Buddha was the Buddha. So there's only one Buddha at a time from the point of view of Theravada.
So in Theravada, everybody doesn't have Buddha nature?
That's right. It's not talked about that way.
Oh, shoot.
That's right. It's not viewed about quite that way. I'm not quite sure how they view the continuity of like consciousness. I'm not quite sure how that's viewed in Theravada. I haven't really studied that. But there must be some notion there that, you know, when you attain arhatship, you know, obviously there's still something going on. But exactly how that relates with complete, unsurpassable, complete great enlightenment, like a Buddha, it's not that. Arhatship is not the same as the Buddha. The Buddha is the great, they call him the great Bodhisattva. But, you know, he's the only one who's the Bodhisattva. It's not like everyone could be a Bodhisattva. So it's a different view that way. Arhatship is still considered liberation from samsara. But the role of a Buddha is considered different. Now, from the point of view of Mahayana, actually, you know, the Buddha is your very nature. And so everyone can practice, become a bodhisattva and actually practice like the Buddha did through many lifetimes. In one lifetime, you could practice all of those steps that the Buddha did through countless lifetimes. So it becomes much more possible to attain enlightenment. And even more so with Vajrayana, it's considered even more possible to become enlightened in one lifetime. So it's a matter of understanding reality. The degree to which you have a view of what's going on is the degree to which you practice the skillful means available to you that promote that view. So if you don't have that view, then you're not practicing skillful means to promote that view. You see what I mean? So therefore, the fruition is looked at as being, you know, the cessation of craving, the cessation of all, you know, dualistic fixation on a personal level. But of course, Mahayana, the view is, it is everything's on fire, the whole, you know, all the sentient beings are suffering. And that's more important than my peace, than my liberation. Until everyone's liberated, there is no such thing. It's not complete enlightenment without everyone being, because we're disconnected, we're not separate, ultimately. That's real non-dualism. Is we're not separate from other sentient beings. So how can we abandon them?
Yeah. I mean, I keep trying to match up the teachings with my life, and it's questionable how enlightened I am. But anyway.
well, join the club.
Yeah. Okay. And what comes up for me around, you know, sort of, it sounds like diving back in, kind of like, but hopefully better than diving back into the confusion, but hopefully not being quite as confused, or knowing better how not to be so confused with others.
Yes. Well, you're learning both how to fully relate with your own confusion, and as you do so, you begin to understand how to relate with others' confusion.
Right.
But the key difference here is that in Mahayana, you... because you're not struggling so much with others. See, there's no struggle with others because you're inviting them into your experience. So that struggle is gone. And therefore, their path becomes your path. And therefore, you go much more deeply and much in a much more vast, profound way into the very essence of the core of what is samsara, what is confusion, what is ignorance. So you're going much more deeply into the actual, you know, cause of suffering for everyone. So therefore, you begin to be able to be a benefit to everyone, you know, because you're actually not just, you know, satisfied with feeling good or feeling peaceful. You know, these are, feeling peaceful is actually, can become an obstacle for any practitioner, Buddhist practitioner, actually. So, because, you know, we start with mindfulness, and mindfulness develops into awareness. But if you become attached to the peaceful feeling of mindfulness, that can become an obstacle. If you don't have a meditation instructor, you could actually spend your entire life just practicing shamatha. And this is actually an obstacle that's talked about with Tibetan yogis who were found in caves that became so good at one-pointed meditation that they became frozen in a kind of samadhi, in a kind of state that was actually, they appeared dead, but they actually weren't really dead. And they could live for literally hundreds of years in that state. And they found bodies like that. So there's this obstacle right there that is kind of shows you how tricky it is, even for someone who's studied a lot, that if you don't have a master or someone who reflects your path back to you, you could really get the wrong idea and get fixated on a particular result. So the thing about Mahayana is, you know, that we begin with kindness to ourselves, developing, getting to actually making friends with ourselves, which is happens through the practice of shamatha. That is to say that we are willing to relate with each thing that comes up and, you know, notice it and come back, and without trying to get rid of it, we actually relate with it as it is, experience it as it is. And therefore, we're beginning to allow ourselves to be unbiased and unconditional. Actually, it's kind of unconditionality to be willing to just be with it as it is. And that's actually the beginning of friendship. If you think about what is real friendship, you know, what does it mean to have a real friend? It's some kind of unconditionality that they're not going to go running when you're confused or having a bad day. You know, that's not a true friend. A true friend kind of gets the, hey, you're having a hard time. But I know you more than this hard time you're going through. I know you more deeply than that. And that's precisely what starts to happen in meditation practice, as we begin to experience that these things come and go, and that they're not as solid as we always thought they were. We start to see what they're made of. All of our different states of mind have components to them. Rather than being one solid mass, we start to experience that there's a belief behind it. If we can stay with it and just be with it, we start to see what it's made of. And we start to see the beliefs and all the things that created that particular grasping to that particular thing. And so that's what's called knowledge. We begin to gain knowledge into our own mind, and we become friends with ourselves because we're not afraid anymore of any states of mind, because we begin to know how to work with our mind. And so that's really being friends with yourself, is you feel you can be with yourself unconditionally. And then gradually, you know, what starts to happen is when you're not struggling with yourself, there's a tremendous clarity that begins to dawn, because you're not spending all that energy, you know, generating what's going to make you feel good and get away from what you don't like and try to stay, you know, all that energy you use creates a lot of confusion. So when you're not doing that anymore, suddenly you start to see things with great clarity. And that's the beginning of what we call awareness. And that clarity includes you start to see, because you're no longer projecting so much, trying to, you know, projecting what you want and what you believe is a problem about yourself or about your world, projecting that into the environment. Since you're not doing that, the environment begins to become very vivid, and you start to experience spaciousness. The real, that there's really been space there all along that you were filling. You weren't even aware you were doing it. But then you begin to realize that space has been there all along, but just I've been filling it. So then you start to trust the space, and you begin to actually be able to begin to relate with your world in a whole different way. And that is the beginning, really, of where your friendliness towards yourself can begin to extend into your world. That happens through the awareness. And that, of course, is also, you know, that's going to be talked about more when you get to the class on compassion. He'll go really into how, where that goes. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, what you're saying makes a lot of sense. And one of my favorite sayings, it's not very Buddhist, is that life always kind of throws me curveballs. Maybe that's my way of re-engaging with the world from a peaceful place or something. But do you think that this could also be a process where with that curveball you go back into some kind of working with yourself, which can still go out, but it's like a constant kind of going all the way through the whole number. But sometimes you get blindsided or something. At least I do.
Yeah, sure.
and then it's a process of making friends with myself in that situation, and then gradually having some compassion for. I mean that. Maybe that's just sort of baby steps or something.
Well, I mean, I'm not sure. I don't know much about your practice. And do you have a teacher? Do you have a teacher?
I don't have it in mind. No.
Anyway, there's a lot more to know before I could really.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, but basically, yes, what you're saying is true, that as you discover, you know, as you discover that you really don't know what's going on, which actually is true. You know, all these curveballs that happen, mm-hmm. Before you thought they shouldn't happen. See, that's what we thought. It shouldn't happen. Why is this happening to me?
Yeah.
And more you practice, the more you realize it's always going to happen. Mm-hmm. Everything is changing. Everything's impermanent. So consequently, your path becomes much more kind of flexible, about flexibility, and realizing that each situation provides you with a new, you know, path, further path, mm-hmm. to learning about your own reactions to it, and, you know, and being with it as it is. You stay with it as it is, and that becomes a further enrichment, mm-hmm. of your path. So that's the idea. It's rather than it becoming, you know, the better I get, these shouldn't happen to me.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
It
was like
actually the opposite.
It's actually the opposite.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Well, then I must be right.
Yeah. Yeah. Our lineage, the Kagyu lineage, is called the mishap lineage.
Yeah. Yeah.
And mishaps are considered pretty good news.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, how is this all related to the first thing that you said? May all beings enjoy happiness. At the root of happiness.
Well, that's called Maitri, and that someone's going to talk about that first one next week.
Oh, okay.
Bill is. So he's going to talk about Maitri next week. So I don't want to say too much about it.
Okay.
But I just wanted to create a bridge into Mahayana, which is just saying that that is the ground upon which we enter into this vision of the world is actually, it's not so simple of just kind of dissecting confusion and being able to stop feeling agitated and feel at peace. That's part of it. That's the shamatha part. And the part of the vipassana part as well. Is to actually, I mean, the arhats have great vipassana too. But there's a different attitude, a different view going on there. And that's all. I was just trying to point that out. But to talk a little more about, because this is a very important part. Oh my goodness. It goes so fast. Let me just say a little bit about absolute bodhicitta. It's a very important aspect of it. So there's two parts to it, the relative, which is this aspiration, the sense that you do practices to cultivate, in Mahayana you do practices to cultivate, you know, compassion and loving kindness and and you study the Dharma, which explains about, you know, countless sentient beings. I mean, it's unbelievable when you read these things about how many worlds there are, how many sentient beings there are. And, you know, they say, you know, as many sands as there are sands in the Ganges. They say, you know, for each sand, another Ganges river. And if you counted all of those, there's more worlds than that. You know, each grain of sand, another Ganges river, there's more worlds with sentient beings in them than that. It's incredible. So it's an amazing number. And I actually had a PhD mathematics guy do some figuring on this, and it was very interesting what he came up with. But so essentially, you know, one of the things that studying the Mahayana does is it completely explodes this sense of finite, the finite nature that we tend to see things in a very small way. You know, it kind of explodes it into, well, actually, this is huge. There's a huge world, a huge universe of sentient beings that all we could connect with all of them and help all of them. And that's a beautiful vision and very profound and very powerful and very noble, you know, very noble to take that view. And therefore, there's a sense of, you know, the bodhisattvas are sometimes, you know, the bodhisattva path is viewed as the most important thing. You know, the Buddha is obviously the example of enlightenment, but the bodhisattvas are the example of how to become a Buddha. So the bodhisattva path is like the real, you know, thing that's emphasized. You know, of course, once you realize your Buddha nature fully, you are then no different than the Buddha. At that point, you cease to be a bodhisattva. Then you're a Buddha, and which is, you know, inconceivable. But it's sort of like almost like another dimension or something of life. You can't really see it so easily from where we sit, but that there's just unlimited amount of good that you can do for others, of how you can help others. It becomes vastly, profoundly great. You know, the more enlightened you are, the more able you are to help sentient beings. So therefore, so the ultimate bodhicitta, let me just quickly say something about that. So, you know, I said that the Mahayana is profound and vast. So the vastness is really, you know, that sense that there's infinite space, but there's also infinite sentient beings. The profound part is also that each moment, each situation, when you are no longer constrained by the small-mindedness of ego, well then, each situation becomes infinitely deep and infinitely profound. So that it's no longer just, you know, kind of our usual conventional thinking about things. You know, that's a wall. But rather, it becomes something else, that you begin to see the world as it truly is. And this ability to see the world as it truly is, we call, you know, one part of it is called emptiness or wisdom, the wisdom of actually no longer projecting anything onto the world. You're beginning to actually see through all of the concepts that you were fed and all of the concepts you have about what is real. You're beginning to actually see that they are concepts, and you're beginning to learn to become more and more soft, more and more gentle through the Mahayana practice. So much so that you're no longer trying to hold on to concepts or hold on to your beliefs, but you're actually beginning to learn how to allow them to fall apart more and more deeply. And the more it falls apart, the more you begin to see the profundity of what's actually, you know, in front of you, be it a person or a thing or whatever. There's infinite possibilities of interaction with your world, infinite depth, infinite intimacy. You know, it's just, that's profound. It's very profound. It's beyond concept, totally beyond concept. So you can't really talk about it. You could just sort of talk about, you know, where it's like, it's profound. it's unbelievable, supposedly. Yeah. But as we go along, you know, Trigam Trungpa even says in this book here, this book is great, it's part of a three-volume book taken from his seminars called the seminaries, which were the three-month-long programs he taught his senior students for many years. And so someone edited all those talks and kind of put it into a form that's readable for anyone. And so there's a Hinayana book, a Mahayana book, and a Vajrayana book. And this is the Mahayana book. But he says in there that I lost it. Oh, well.
Went that away.
That was ultimate bodhicitta.
Ultimate Bodhicitta, yeah, there it is.
Yeah. There are no words there.
That's right. Could be ultimate. Could be just Buddha kind of ignorance.
Could be
just confusion. Yeah. So anyway, so ultimate Bodhicitta is what we call shunyata or emptiness. Emptiness sounds very ooh, you know. It sounds like very almost abstract to a lot of people because the way it's been described through the years by many authors is very archaically described, very, you know, not at all, I think, easily understood. But and not that I could, in one sentence, make it understandable, but one thing that is clear to me is that, you know, as I've understood shunyata from what I've read and little glimpses, there is... it's completely beyond concepts. Our Buddha nature, the way that we fundamentally are, is not bound by a particular concept ever. Mm-hmm. We have concepts because we feel comfortable being able to name things and feel like we know where we are and what it is. But we end up getting attached to that, and that's part of the more subtle element of our confusion, is we're so attached to how we think about our world, how we conceptualize our world. So that's another level at which we need to go into in our practice. Eventually, we go down to that level to where even language becomes let go of on some level. You go beyond language even, and therefore you're no longer bound by the limitations of seeing things, you know, conditioned by what your word for them is even. So we're talking about a very huge world. So the world becomes very huge because it's no longer limited by how you tend to conceptualize it. Okay, so that's that world of vastness is the world and unconditionality. That is the world of ultimate bodhicitta, and that is really where, you know, things like compassion actually are. That's where they come out of. You know, when you reach that level of complete clarity and connectedness with the universe, at that point, you know, there's no distinction between you and what you're looking at. You know, I mean, in the sense of something between you and it that has some condition. You're not conditioning things by what you believe about them. So consequently, you can actually have tremendous... You have the ability to really utilize the whole universe as a further path for yourself and for others. So it becomes very skillful. The path becomes very skillful, and your teachings can become, you know, extraordinarily to the point with whoever you're talking to. Just what they need. You can see what they need because you see what they're projecting. If you're that clean, if you're that clear, you just see what people are, where they're stuck, and you can actually help them to see it because you see it. So you become a mirror to others, and people hate that. Some people hate that. Yeah. But if you're a student, you have to put up with that because that's a big part of your path is being mirrored by your teacher. And by other sangha, by other students as well, you get mirrored. And that's a big part of the discomfort of being in the sangha, you know. The sangha is not about being in a club where everyone, we like each other because we all have the same beliefs. you know, just the opposite. You know, this is about deconstructing all the things that make you comfortable. So consequently, it can be very irritating to be in the Sangha. Very irritating. Sometimes you don't even want to look at someone because you go, oh, just let me have a little bit of my comfort, please. And some people get very scared of the teacher and don't want to be near them because it's too challenging. So, you know, it's really wonderful that there is such authenticity in the world. Therefore, it's possible for us to be taken apart brick by brick and really see what's going on, really see it the way it is. It's extraordinary. So I think I'll stop talking now. And we have just a few minutes left. If anyone has any other questions, please. I'm sorry, I kind of get going.
Maybe one thing else you could touch on.
Yep.
Limitless, and that you have the ultimate, but the limitlessness or immeasurableness of the four things.
Why is it called immeasurable?
Right.
Because at their core, they are both working with both relative and absolute bodhicitta. You need both, you see. You need the relative bodhicitta because that's your path. The relative is just like we need to meditate. Meditating is a relative thing. You have to find a seat, you have to find a place, you have to sit down, you have a technique, whatever you do. It's all relative stuff. That's called path. But then, you know, you have the actual unconditional Buddha nature at the same time. So both of those work together, and you have to have both.
So we're working with loving kindness, we work with it and try to develop more.
Right.
And yet when we really get to it, we find out what there's no end to it.
Well, we find out, that's right, we find out that it's our very nature.
Right.
To have loving kindness is actually our nature.
An unlimited supply.
There's no boundary.
There's no boundary,
there's
yeah.
no boundary between. This is when you do the practice of the four immeasurables, which Bill will introduce next week. The one of the views of it is that you begin to recognize that there is no difference, in a sense, between you, the people you're closest to, and the people who even annoy you. That everyone is looking for the same.
Yeah.
You know? And so there's a kind of no boundary between you and others. That's the immeasurable. And that's because your mind is balanced. Your mind is balanced and unbalanced.
Also, yeah, another aspect that I left out is an important one. Is the absence of ambition. That's another general quality that we are usually very caught in, and that's something that also is we're free from in the absolute bodhicitta. We're free from ambition. We're free from, you know, hope and fear. And it's very kind, very gentle, and very brave, extremely brave.
And you used the word unbiased.
Unbiased.
And that's really what the view of the four immeasurables is, to become, recognize, to be unbiased.
Yeah, but to me, the place where the rubber meets the road, actually, like in practice, is the learning to not tweak anything, to not mess with anything. That's where you develop the softness and the gentleness, is being able to more and more and more honor things as they arise, as they are. And then you become more, less and less struggling with anything. And that's how you become more and more gentle. Is through that.
And then that becomes with other people too.
That's with other people as well.
Yeah, just hearing all this view, it seems like it's good to have a view, because like you said, that gets you going in the right direction and asking the right questions. And,
right.
And it also seems like there's a danger for having the view that you think you're somewhere when you're not, or you think you're enlightened when you're not, or that I should be enlightened, or all that junk.
Yes. Of course, that's why we have a path.
Yeah.
Because we're always making mistakes. And yes. So that's the nature of the path.
Yeah. Okay. as long as you can just keep getting that mirror, whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, and also you have to be willing to be mirrored. That's so important. You know, sometimes we talk about one of the obstacles is, you know, people, even though they're Mahayanists, they're actually Pratyeka Buddhas. That's people who actually don't want to have a teacher. They want to do it all alone. So they're solitary practitioners, and they don't have a sangha. They don't even have necessarily have a teacher. And so that, you know, there's some people that can go a long way, even though they're Pratyeka Buddhas. It's not that they can't, but it's limited. It's definitely limited. So, you know, it's important to have the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. You need those three things to have a complete path. And it's good to look at, am I missing one of those? And if you are, then your path isn't complete yet. It's okay, you know, that happens to us for a while. But at some point, if you want to have a complete path, you need to have all three of those.
I'm just saying the teacher needs to be trustworthy. And sometimes that's been an issue here.
Oh, sure. Well, you need to really be certain before you ask them to be your teacher. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But they're still human beings.
Right. Of course. You know. But let's hope so.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, there's this whole, sometimes there's a perfectionistic element that we can project expectations of them being perfect. You know? Uh-huh. And then you find out, you know, they drink gin, or they smoke a cigarette, or they...
Or they're addicted to video games or something.
Yeah. Or they, you know, whatever it may be. Yeah, I mean, theoretically, if someone is very realized, they wouldn't be addicted, but they might like it. Mm-hmm. I have a great story about that, actually. Zen master came to the United States. I think this is about Miyazumi Roshi. It's supposed to be a true story. But anyway, Zen master came to the United States, and he went out for Kentucky Fried Chicken. And he just absolutely loved it. You know this story? He absolutely loved it. And so he came back home that night after eating, and he had diarrhea, and he was sick. And then the next night, he went out again and had it again. Loved it. Came back home, was sick, had diarrhea. And, of course, he was going out with his American disciple, student. And he went for weeks. He did this. For weeks, he kept going out and eating it and being sick. Finally, the student said, "Roshi, you know this is going to make you sick. Why do you keep doing it?" I said, "Because I like it and I can stand the pain." I mean...
Sounds familiar.
Yeah. Sounds familiar. Yeah. It's a guy thing.
No, I don't think so.
No. But guys do that a lot.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
We'll just keep doing the same thing because we like it. Yeah. And then we'll just take the punishment for doing it.
Did you have anything to say, Marcia?
Did you have something to say about that?
No, I mean, it's a very interesting conversation that you're having, and I can relate to what you're saying. As a Zen practitioner, we have, you know, things that are a little bit different, but in general, I understand where you're going. I think for me, to have a life where you have concentration and clarity and equanimity in your life is certainly understandable. And I think, of course, this is a bad question to ask at the end when you're getting to close, but enlightenment is, to me, my understanding of enlightenment is that it's an action rather than something that really happens to you, that it's something that we're constantly striving for in our actions. So I'm always confused about how enlightenment and what that word, because it's just a word, what it actually in fact means, if something that temporarily happens to you, or if it's something that you carry after you think that it's happened to you, or if in reality it's something that is not even anything tangible, and it's just part of who we are.
Well, that's a good question to ask an enlightened teacher.
Yeah.
And I'm not one, but you know, having been a long student a long time, and having talked about this stuff for a long, long time and studied it, I could give you my view of what you're saying.
Sure.
Okay, and maybe it'll help tell me if it does or doesn't. But generally speaking, Trungpa Trungpa once said, "If you think you're enlightened, you're not." That's one part of it. And then the other part of it is, Suzuki Roshi said, if you practice, enlightenment may happen for some, but even if it doesn't happen, it's almost as good. Yeah. I thought that's pretty cool. And then, you know, another perspective is that we all have little glimpses of actually the awakened state of mind. But it's so kind of not part of our everyday fixated mind that we tend to not notice it. You know, we tend to consider it to be an interruption, even. And sometimes, you know, we regard it as slightly unpleasant, that level of discontinuity, that interruption, you know. But what makes it enlightenment, according to what I've read, what I've studied, what makes it enlightenment, it is not temporary. That's the difference. So there's temporary experiences that might have kind of aspects of your enlightened nature within that experience. Sometimes it's emptiness, sometimes it's luminosity. So, you know, there's a number of them, temporary experiences, that can be quite profound and powerful. And they're like, you know, you take some kind of inspiration from those. But the idea is you don't try to repeat them ever, because it becomes an obstacle if you try to repeat it. So you just, because your enlightened nature is not something you, because it's unconditional, you can't hold on to it. So therefore, it's actually a matter of, you know, gradually, you know, it's said that, you've heard of the Bhumis? Have you heard of the Bhumis?
No.
That's sort of the description of the stages of awakening of a bodhisattva. Okay, so there's 10 Bhumis. And the last one is complete Buddhahood. The 11th, I guess, Bhumi is complete Buddhahood. So that's a lot of Bhumis. That begins with the experience, direct experience of emptiness, the first Bhumi. And that's, if you have that all the time, that's the first Bhumi. If you realize all the time the difference between what I'm generating and the real world, if you have that all the time, that's called the first Bhumi, experiencing shunyata, or emptiness, all the time. And that's just the beginning of the journey of becoming a Buddha. That's the first level. And each one is said to be inconceivably vaster and more profound than the one before, going all the way up to the 10th Bhumi. So it's like inconceivable, you know. But you could read about it, actually. And it's good to read about the Bhumis, because then you can kind of look at your own practice, you know, kind of see, you know, well, I guess I'm not on the first Bhumi yet. You know, that kind of thing. Anyway, we should stop. Huh?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.